Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We might remember, as we stride between the hallowed dates of two great 18th century revolutions, one symbolized by the Liberty Bell, the other the guillotine, that both celebrations occur during the month named for Julius Caesar, who abolished the Roman Republic. On the same July 2nd date that the American Revolutionary Congress seceded from England, the great Shawnee chief Tecumseh called to arms all native tribes to unite against Yankee Doodle Paleface encroachment 33 years later in 1809. And in 1848, a year when most European nations were engrossed in revolutions, Marx and Engels published the Communist Manifesto, which changed nearly everything. And not to forget America's twin Emancipation Day, Juneteenth of 1865. This next Tuesday, July 14th, is Bastille Day 221. So viva liberty, equality, fraternity. I begin today's program with the antithesis of liberty and justice for all, a presumptuous, swell-headed Caesar with, in the words of Robert Browning, an itch for the praise of fools. I wrote it, sign of the swine. Donald Trump is America's 666th president. As president, he projects a beastly comic book freak, such as the Hulk, except there is no redeeming side to his character. A human ogre of swinish egomania and depraved indifference. He grabs at the presidency like a baby toy to shake, rattle, and smash apart. He declares himself above the law, eroding truth and honesty as ruthlessly as a crime boss. His virulent narcissism is especially revealed in his self-portrayal as America's great white hope. He regards everybody not white or racist right wing of disputing his ugly reactionary coup against democracy and constitutional governments, and thereby enemies of the state and traitors to his xenophobic cause of white supremacy and creation of albino nation. This founding father aspect of his egocentric dementia seems pervasive since the day he descended like a god in his golden escalator from the top of Trump Tower 5 years ago. From the beginning of his improbable residency in the White House, he has disparaged non-white peoples, built walls of opinion, if not quite successfully borders, against their immigration, and deports and imprisons as many as he is able, legally or otherwise, and he caustically slurs persons of color, even while he claims respect for them. Trump now has about 5 months to complete his xenophobic dissolution of American pluralistic democracy. How many Americans count the days with fervency that he might be gone, or fear he won't vacate the White House in the event he is presented with an eviction notice in November. Each day that passes might optimistically be one day less of his governing misanthropy, yet each day engulfs the nation deeper into the morass of his depraved indifference to life, liberty, and the all-American demographic democracy. Trump's infinite capacity for bottomless degeneracy is a confluence of misanthropies. His unexpected and certainly unwarranted hoist to power that has induced deceit, avarice, corruption, and intolerance all through American society. A short-term heedlessness to long-lasting consequences of egregious desolation and disruption of democratic life and liberty, and the unforgivable escalation of racial hatred and gender disparity. Everyone should be aware of the chilling future without constitutional democracy, imperfect as it is, but never so pernicious as the zealotry, confabulation, discriminations of every gangrenous sort, and of course, the latent tyranny that has befouled the past nearly 4 years. And perhaps Trump's most disgusting legacy, the erosion of truth, may well be the primary debilitating cancer in the long term of our recovery. The USA after Trump might after all be a dying democracy, his corrupt, decrepit tenure a fatal gravitational collapse into a black hole by a star that rose too quickly and has consumed itself with careless and misguided hubris. Whatever greatness we have possessed, which was the quest for liberty and justice for ordinary people, seems to be swiftly disintegrating, perhaps because we have not been wholeheartedly inclusive, especially in regard to race and gender equality uppermost. Despite an overwhelming recent realization of democracy's patent shortchanging and a sizable majority of Americans' attempt to rectify the original sins of racism and sexual misogyny, atavistic avatar Trump thwarts relighting liberty's lamp. If indeed the USA does succumb to a vicious epidemic of scornful tyranny, as life-threatening as the coronavirus plague, it might be hoped that a future people, who would be up against odds of impudent climate change and possible extinction in the near by and by, will struggle against similar human tyrannies as our ancestors once did. We are truly our own worst enemies, undermining survival on a once bountiful but rapidly alien planet, and being undermined regularly by those of our species who can credibly be considered treacherous weasels. Politics is essentially war without the killing, aside from assassinations and the like. Yet politics can be defined as perpetual conflict, always in crises, real and contrived. Politics acts as much a buffer to war as it creates crises that explode into war. The current political climate in the USA is one of incendiary revision, of savage descent to public ignorance and intolerance, which are generally present but not always accorded the scorn and scandal as the Trumpian malversation. Trump's swinish xenophobia insists that his brand of nouveau fascism is an inevitable replacement of what he inarticulately sputters as democracy's failure, which is actually his persistent, blundering demagoguery. He enacts the self-styled role of destroyer-in-chief of nearly everything that sustains the lives and sense of worth for the majority of ordinary citizens, whom he disdains to such a degree that their deaths by the hundreds of thousands from the pandemic plague seem of no concern other than the effect upon his chances to retain the presidency. The grim irony of such Trumpy sorts of persons who claim supreme privilege is that they are obscenely acquisitive for power, yet are grossly incompetent, intolerant, and even criminal in its use. And so we see Trump himself posturing at Mount Rushmore before a crowd of acolytes he has essentially befouled to sickness and death so as to quench his raging narcissism. He quite obviously is campaigning for his florid, baggy, albescent face to be carved in granite among the tarnished immortals on Mount Rushmore. A ritualistic official painted portrait of Trump as president, which is normal archival totemry, should be only of his face, colored in shades of fiery and purpled red, except for a tangerine forelock. He should be howling in wide open mouth rage with all his predatory teeth visible, and he should be staring straight out from the canvas to intimidate anyone who dares to look, and his malevolent, igneous eyes reflect an image of hell. Which brings to mind the caricature of another discredited and impeached president, Richard Nixon, and his first vice president, also a criminal, cartooned as cooks in a gag and barf diner. A scowling Nixon shoves a plate of red, white, and blue spaghetti and meatballs at whomever stops to look. "Shut up and eat it," Nixon snarls. It seems almost axiomatic that the most hateful among us demand to be beloved. The persistent question, Do the values of democracy paralyze us to its flagrant electoral coup and dismantling by a loathsome bull weevil of a fake president who is unfit to represent or govern democracy? Although the country is in severe mental distress, it is not yet coming apart, despite the added prevalence of a killer plague. Americans are resisting white nationalist racism. They are fighting back with democracy, which infuriates Trump and his insidiously corrupt cohorts. Our tattered democracy seems inclined to persevere, greatly assisted by Trump's unstable penchant for turmoil in consort with his unfettered dishonesty, which is certainly providing a useful study of the self-immolation of a repulsive occupant of the people's house. Of course, none of this is unusual. The exalted founders were very aware of this sort of imperial behavior, and following their own struggle with it, devised a constitution and bill of rights to at least curtail the worst excesses of greed, inequity, and the menacing grasp for absolute power. History is not irrelevant or meaningless, as many suggest, or it would not be as spectacularly distorted as it is in this bizarre age of Trump, who disregards historical veracity in his aggressive quest to dismantle democracy and impose the evils of white male supremacy and homegrown fascism. Yet how else might we find precedents to deflect Trump's iniquitous impulses, except through research of similar necrological demons, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Napoleon, even Vlad the Impaler and Torquemada come to mind. The wicked boy emperors of ancient Rome, Caligula and Nero, seem closest to Trump. However, in their megalomaniacal comparability of ignorant arrogance and sadistic stupidity, Caligula was killed by his own soldiers, not a rarity in old Rome. Nero apparently suicided before a mob got to him, following Rome's immolation. Trump is Caligula Nero personified. Before his negligent callousness allowed the USA to become a pandemic ward, Trump made it a vicious asylum of brutish incompetence. Adolf Hitler said, "The efficiency of the truly national leader consists primarily in preventing the division of the attention of a people and always in concentrating it on a single enemy." Trump says, "The radical ideology attacking our country advances under the banner of social justice, but in truth, it would demolish justice and society." Hitler said, "The national government will maintain and defend the foundations on which the power of our nation rests." Trump says, "Our country is witnessing a merciless campaign to erase our history. One of the political weapons is cancel culture. This is the very definition of totalitarianism." Hitler said, "We want to burn out the poison of immorality which has entered into our whole life and culture as a result of liberal excess during the past few years." Trump says, "Our nation is witnessing a merciless campaign to defame our heroes, erase our values, and indoctrinate our children. Angry mobs are trying to tear down the statues of our founders, deface our most sacred memorials, and unleash a wave of violent crime in our cities." Hitler said, "We want to fill our culture again with the Christian spirit. We want to burn out all the recent immoral developments in literature, in the theater, and in the press. We want to fill our culture again with the Christian spirit as the very basis of our collective morality." Trump says, "We will not be tyrannized, we will not be demeaned, and we will not be intimidated by bad, evil people." Hitler's followers generally shouted cries of "Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil." Trump's coronavirus exposed crowds chant "USA, USA, USA." And that was Sign of the Swine, or Swine Sign, which I wrote. And now, from Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. we need to protect our post offices. I'm worried about the continuing threats to dismantle our post offices via privatization. On April 12, 2018, Trump signed an order creating a federal task force to propose structural reforms in the U.S. Postal Office. And on June 22, the task force, composed entirely of top Trump officials, concluded, prepare USPS for future conversion from a government agency into a privately held corporation. Seriously? Trump's task force conceded that our postal service is regularly cited as the federal agency with the highest public approval rating, 88% according to a February 2018 Pew poll. That postal service approval rating dwarfs approval for Trump and the congressional critters trying to kill it. Consider these facts about our postal service. The 630,000 postal workers and letter carriers literally deliver for us in every zip code. Working from 31,508 local POs, they trundle 150 billion pieces of mail a year, 4 million miles a day, to 157 million addresses across the land, and they deliver them within a few days. That's what I deem efficient. Carriers carry their loads door to door, riding snowmobiles, flying bush planes, running mail boats, and even riding to the bottom of the Grand Canyon on mules. USPS does all that without taking a dime from taxpayer funds, financing their operations entirely from its sales and services to customers. That's an unmatched bargain and genuine public good that links all of America's far-flung people and communities into one. That's why the right-wingers are dead set on killing it. For decades, extreme anti-government propagandists have specifically targeted the post office, mocking it as a bloated, antiquated, bankrupt bureaucracy made obsolete by email and slick, highly promoted private outfits like FedEx and UPS. Unable to find a real flaw in the Postal Service, opponents manufactured a fake one in 2006. Congress enacted an enhancement provision requiring the USPS to pre-fund the health and pension benefits for all postal retirees 75 years in advance, including those not even born. Think about that. That arbitrary, unprecedented requirement to pay now for the retirement benefits of future employees has piled a $6.9 billion a year false cost on the agency's balance sheet. By cooking the books with that false entry, the right wing has been able to wail that our post office is broke and bleeding money, threatening taxpayers with a massive bailout. That shameful 75-year pre-funding decree is a burden that no other private corporation or government agency is forced to carry. Take it away, and presto, the post office is a moneymaker. Even worse than the right's bogus claims of USPS insolvency is the actual exorbitant cost we citizens would pay for the proposed privatization. If Trump and company get their way, privatizing the Postal Service, we would get mail delivery just a few days each week and pay ever-rising fees for the privilege. The cost of stamps would likely rise based on corporate whim, and the likely closure of many small-town post offices would create havoc for many. One sad effect of the privatization campaign is that our current postal service would lose its incentive to innovate, as it has had to do for decades. The privatizer lobby has prevented the PO from offering postal banking to the 88 million lower-income Americans who are essentially unbanked and must rely on rip-off check-cashing outfits and predatory lenders. Our Postal Service already has the infrastructure, service experience, and customer credibility to provide essential basic banking services, from low-cost check cashing and small donor loans to savings accounts and money transfers. It's a ready market, a public service, and a common-sense multi-billion-dollar revenue stream for USPS, a win-win. But the privatizers have stopped every effort in Congress to allow that innovation for the public good. We have to be vigilant. The privatizers are rich, principled, and determined. The post office is a huge part of America's history, culture, and economy, and without it, our lives would be much more difficult. Nothing symbolizes our fight for the democratic ideal of the common good more than our public post office. This essential, egalitarian, nationwide service is literally us. and is the only agency enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 7. Those 31,585 branches belong to us, not a handful of rich corporate bandits. Our Postal Service is daily proof that we really are all in this together. So everyone, buy a few rolls of stamps and tell your carriers and postal clerks how much you appreciate their service. And that was Dr. Robert Brake from Ocean Park, Washington. We need to protect our post offices. And now, Bloody Thursday, which I wrote. Today, 86 years ago, two union men shot down by police while on strike in San Francisco were given a stupendous funeral. 86 years ago this summer, San Francisco was paralyzed by the largest general strike staged by labor unions in the USA. It started as a maritime strike in the spring of 1934, when thousands of longshoremen, stevedores as they were called at the time, walked off the job because they were sick of bad pay and humiliating treatment. They were joined by seamen, teamsters, and other maritime and industrial unions, and through unanimous action, closed the port of San Francisco for more than 2 months. No ship was loaded or unloaded. No cargo was moved off the docks. In sympathy with the strikers, longshoremen went out on strike in Seattle, Tacoma, Bellingham, Aberdeen, Grays Harbor, Astoria, Portland, Stockton, Los Angeles, San Diego, and all other Pacific Coast ports. The strike was a bloody one. Pickets and police fought each other, pitched battles, with guns, gas, and clubs arrayed against rocks, bricks, and fists. The Industrial Association, a group of ship owners, presidents of stevedore companies, and other maritime executives, made itself San Francisco's legal authority and continually attempted to open the port with scabs and police, and through hysterical newspaper and radio accounts that labeled the strikers as communists and aliens, which many were. But no matter where they came from or what they believed in, the strikers sought justice and resisted all attempts to outmaneuver them or force them back to work with nothing settled. The battles grew in ferocity until at the beginning of July they were as savage as a war. On July 3rd, the 70th anniversary of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg during the Civil War, thousands of strikers and police fought all day. The July 4th holiday provided a truce and the day passed peaceably. But in the early morning of Thursday, July 5th, the fighting resumed where it had left off when police and scabs attempted once more to open the port. Two strikers were shot dead by police revolvers, and several hundred suffered gunshot wounds. Hundreds more were hospitalized or dragged into hiding after they were injured by gas and clubs. Mike Quinn, who was a participant of the 1934 maritime strike and a close associate of the strike leader, an Australian stevedore named Harry Bridges, wrote an account of Bloody Thursday in his book, The Big Strike. He summed up the day's fighting, which brought in 200 National Guardsmen equipped with rapid-fire guns, machine guns, gas equipment, and bayoneted rifles, Quinn wrote. He wrote that all day long newspapers had been pouring out extra after extra. The word blood, blood, blood recurred every three or four lines. So much blood had been seen that it obsessed the minds of news writers, and the word was repeated again and again, almost involuntarily, as they typed their copy. Quinn wrote that the strikers named the day Bloody Thursday. On Monday, July 9th, 1934, a funeral march was held for the two strikers shot to death by police on Bloody Thursday, Howard Sperry and Nicholas Bourdois. 40,000 men, women, and children marched in silence, 8 and 10 abreast, the length of Market Street, behind trucks that carried the two coffins and flowers. A newspaper described the procession as a river of men flowing up Market Street like cooling lava. Another newspaper said that the two strikers in life wouldn't have commanded a second glance on the streets of San Francisco, but in death they were borne the length of Market Street in a stupendous and reverent procession that astounded the city. A week later, a general strike was declared in San Francisco, and the city was effectively shut down for 3 days. The maritime strike ended in late July 1934, and the port of San Francisco was reopened. The maritime unions were awarded recognition, contracts were signed, and demands were met or promised to be met through arbitration, among them the crucial issue of hiring halls to be controlled by the unions and a ban on blacklisting strikers. Longshore pay was raised and dockside hours shortened. But all this did not bring peace to the waterfront, Mike Quinn wrote several years later. The whole maritime strike broke out again 2 years later in greater force than ever. The Great Maritime Strike of 1934 was the harbinger of future labor battles in steel, auto, rubber, and other smokestack industries in the USA. We have had strikes on the waterfront since 1934, Harry Bridges said later, but never again have the bosses dared to shoot our men down in cold blood. Bridges, who once famously defined a communist as any man who wants a nickel more than the boss is willing to pay, said that ultimately the powers of any union of the workers rests on the courage and conviction in its ranks. That is one fundamental truth that has not altered since 1934, nor will it in times to come. For many years after Bloody Thursday, each July 5th was commemorated by maritime workers who took unauthorized days off to march once again up Market Street in honor of the two martyred strikers. And that was Bloody Thursday. And this is Michael McCusker. On the 4th of July, 1855, Walt Whitman self-published the first edition of Leaves of Grass, considered the most influential and quite possibly beloved volume of poetry in the USA. From the preface of that 1855 edition, "This is what you should do. Love the earth and sun and animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Stand up for the stupid and crazy. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward the people. Take off your hat to nothing, known or unknown, or to any man or number of men. Re-examine all you have been told at school or church or in any book. Dismiss what insults your own soul, and your very flesh shall be a great balm." And that was Walt Whitman. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everyone else, and don't let anyone convince you otherwise. Mask up in public places.